This audiobook is as extracts from The Book from Life on OLD Atlantis, from California 21500 years ago. A Dweller on Two Planets. By Philos the Thibetan or Frederick S. Oliver. 1905. Numbers mentioned in text is reference to page number. A Dweller on Two Planets or The Dividing of the Way was released by Philos the Tibetan through Frederick S. Oliver, 1866-1899, as his amanuensis over a period of 3 years, beginning in 1883. It was completed in 1886 and published in 1905. This book goes into great detail about the employment of dark side energy, which today would be called zero-point energy, anti-gravity, mass transit, and devices such as voice-operated typewriters. Philos the Tibetan spoke of a cigar-shaped, highly manoeuvrable Atlantean flying machine, called a Vaelx, which amazingly resembles numerous 20th-century UFO reports. Atlantis was portrayed as a culture which reached a high level of scientific advancement and technology. Philos portrays a first-person account of Atlantean culture which had reached a high level of technological and scientific advancement. His personal history and that of a group of individuals with whom Philos closely interacted is portrayed in the context of the social, economic, political and religious structures which shaped Posed society. Daily life for Posed citizens included such things as anti-gravity air and submarine craft, television, wireless telephony, aerial water generators, air conditioners and high-speed rail. The book deals with deep esoteric subjects including karma and re-embodiment and describes Philo's final incarnation in 19th century America, where his Atlantean karma played itself out. In that incarnation, as Walter Pearson, gold miner and student of adepts, he traveled to Venus. Hesperus. In a subtle body while his physical form remained at a temple inside Mount Shasta Atlantis, describing his experience with the Hesperian adepts, Philos relates many wonders including artworks depicting three-dimensional hologram scenes that appeared alive. In a detailed personal history of Atlantis and 19th century North America, Philos draws the threads of both lifetimes together in familiar and initiatic terms, revealing equally their triumphs and failures and exposing the cause and effects of karma from one lifetime to another. His life story is written in personal testimony of the law, whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap, and as a warning to this technological age to not repeat the mistakes of the past which lead to the cataclysmic destruction of Atlantis. Posed, Queen of the Waves. Extract. Yes, we were Atlanteans and even Lemurians, but we are also citizens of Venus who have come bearing the Christ in our hearts and the culture of the Mother, which has brought forth such beauty, such crystallization in matter of the glories of the Spirit. On our planet, that you might cultivate that Christ of the heart and that culture of the Mother on earth. Now, beloved, I address you as an ascended master and therefore may speak through this messenger. I am grateful that many have profited from my book, even though there may be a percentage of error resulting from my or another's perceptions. Yet, beloved, these records are true and I bear witness, and I bear witness to much more than that which was written. Extract. I say the quality of God happiness is essential to meet adversity, but the pleasure of the senses in excess does surely detract from the straight and the narrow way. Thus, may your forces be focused that you might not perceive your karma alone, but have an eye and an ear for others who suffer and, taking divine pity upon them, say thereby, there but for the grace of God go I. Extract. May you see yourself in every life who suffers. May you know that as long as life suffers, a part of you is suffering with that life, for God is one. May you understand, as the leaves of my book have given up much profound teaching through the messenger, that the path to be walked is worth every joy that you encounter and every sorrow. For you are sending energy back to God and receiving it again. And as quickly as you send to God light for the transmutation of error, so as quickly does He send to you light that is truth incarnate within you. and this oscillation from your heart to the center of the sun of your IAM presence, to the center of the great central sun is the beginning of the acceleration process whereby you shall know that oscillation to the point of the speed of light and then beyond. Extract. America is beset with the karma that the nation has made since its inception 2 centuries ago. It is beset with ancient records of Atlantis not yet paid. And it is bowed down by a false teaching that is not that of the Christ concerning this karma, concerning accountability. So many false teachers abound and so little discrimination is exercised, even in the New Age movement. Wherever there is a claim or a personality or a new fad or some other exploration into the psychic, there do they run like chickens for feed. Extract. Blessed hearts, find the truth of being in yourself. Find others who have that truth of being. And watch out, for the disease of the carnal mind is idolatry. Most people on or off the spiritual path are idolatrous of themselves, quite pleased with their meager knowledge and even less attainment, which they deem to be great. Know ye not that the first step on the path is one of humility and self-effacement? The first step beyond this is forgiveness toward all life. Extract. Do not jump into the arena of learning to be a psychic channel. Do not jump into those areas where you again jeopardize the soul. For this channeling is a form of spiritism and it does rob you of the very sheath of light that does protect the physical body and the chakras, and this energy once spent is not replenished. Thus, when you experience exhaustion instead of a recharge in the presence of a channel, know that your energy is being drained to sustain that communication, which cannot be from an ascended master if it does drain you. The publication of another edition of that classic of occult literature, A Dweller on Two Planets, or The Dividing of the Way by Philos the Tibetan, prompts the present review for the benefit of a new generation of readers, as well as for older ones who have not yet read this remarkable work. The copyright notices in earlier editions indicate the book was first published in 1894. The preface states that it was written in California between 1884 and 1886 by Frederick S. Oliver under the spirit guidance of Philos, who after many earthly lives now works in and from the higher realms. The work is a fascinating account of the 2 most significant incarnations of Philos and his nearest companions, showing by these case histories the action of the law of karma: whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap, both good and bad. The laws of the spiritual universe, whereby humans are rewarded for their good deeds, and move toward the ultimate elimination of evil by working out the consequences of their head actions, are shown in their slow but unfailing application to individuals. The book is replete with explanations of such problems as the atonement, forgiveness of sins, the spiritual mechanics of physical death and of life in the successively expanding post-mortem conditions. Certain episodes will be particularly enlightening to readers who have been led by Jesus's words, "Before Abraham was, I am," to ponder on the relation of the timeless Christ to the inhabitants of the earth before his manifestation in Judah Atlantis. The swiftly moving story paints an absorbing picture of the customs and daily life in the heyday of a greater Atlantean culture, when they utilized scientific knowledge which the present world is just now regaining. The successive life histories narrate, first the short but brilliant career of Zalm Numinus, born about 13,000 years ago in a family of Atlantean mountaineers, and second the final incarnation of the same soul as Walter Pearson in time to fight in the American Civil War, to mine gold in the Mount Shasta region in the late 1860s, and at last to die in a shipwreck off Bermuda, about 1880. This was 4 years before he began the writing of this book through the hand of Mr. Oliver. Many intermediate lifetimes are omitted. A courageous and ambitious youth, Zalm, after early gaining a fortune in a mining enterprise, attracts the attention of the emperor, wins his way into the highest court circles, and while yet in his 20s is entrusted with a delicate diplomatic mission. Success in this puts him in line for appointment as viceroy of an important distant kingdom brought into the Atlan Empire, but before entering on his duties he is to wed the emperor's niece, Ansemi. The brilliant wedding is interrupted by the entrance of Zaim's mistress, Lilix, herself a young woman of sufficiently high social position to have been a suitable wife. Zaim had deceived her into believing that her foreign birth was a bar to marriage. The fact that she had borne him children had been well concealed, and her great devotion led her to agree to his marriage to Ansemi, although her heart was broken. But her mind gives way under the grief, and she goes distraught to the temple. There, in a highly dramatic scene, she attempts to stab Zaim and herself, that they may be united in death. Furious at the disruption of the ceremony, Manin, the high priest, fatally curses Lilix, turning her into stone on the spot. Metamorphosis. For many weeks Zaim wanders aimlessly about, suffering intense remorse. At last he falls into a trance, during which he finds Lilix in the spirit world, carrying in her arms the bloody ghost of her second child, whom she had killed for Zaim's sake. Although Zaim had been unaware of his second infant, he assumes full responsibility for the destruction of its physical life. His bitter and sincere repentance for his duplicity to Lilix, with his willingness to take upon himself the burden of her guilt, bring both to a spiritual awakening wherein they perceive Christ present with them. After telling them that in a far distant day they will be given opportunity to make amends for their sins, he releases Lilix to realms of peace, while Zaim returns to the duties of the world. Recovering mental and physical health, Zaim leads a small expedition to what is now known as South America in search of gold mines to enhance the imperial revenues. Away from his party, he gets entrapped in an ancient tunnel where he perishes miserably of thirst and hunger. As he lies dying, the high priest, Manin, materializes before him, taunts him, and tells him that his entrapment resulted from the priest's hypnotic influence, and that both his approaching death and the turning of Lilix to stone are mere incidents in Manin's design to thwart the humanitarian projects of the Etlan Emperor. The fact that Manin, under cloak of his office, had long been secretly a worker with the forces of evil, was unknown to the Emperor until the spectacular death of Lilix. Intoxicated by his success in undoing Zaim, Manin boasts that there is no god, but at this moment the Christ appears, denounces the high priest as one who, knowing the good, had nevertheless chosen the path of evil to gain personal power. The Christ blasts the priest out of the stream of human spiritual progress, and then bids Zaim sleep in peace for a time. Zaim awakes first to experiences showing the relation of the physical, the psychic and the spiritual planes. Then the psychic fades after the physical and he enters scenes like those of his boyhood, surrounded by the best aspects of the wholesome, rugged mountaineer life. His surroundings gradually increase in complexity and his experiences gain spiritual depth, all based on a working over and assimilation of whatsoever things were honest, just, pure, lovely and of good report in his last earth life. After the good is absorbed into the soul's basic nature, to manifest as character in the next incarnation, desire to use the enhanced spiritual powers for the good of the world attracts the soul to birth in another body of such parentage, in such time and place as will afford opportunity to undo past ill actions by countervailing good deeds, and to add to the sum total of good in the world. Not every span of earth life is directly key to the previous one. Often many lifetimes devoted to the development of character along other lines intervene before occasion can be found for balancing the account. So Philos is silent as to the many earth lives between that of Zaim in Atlantis and the coming to birth as Walter Pearson about 1840. This is the last time before joining the ranks of those who go no more out. Reverend 3:L2. As Pearson, in the United States, he is placed in circumstances where he can and does rectify the grievous errors of the two Atlantean incarnation. The forgiveness received 13 millenniums earlier had blotted out the memory of his sins. Christ then has now saved the repentant sinner from carrying such a millstone about his neck, and had worked slowly to bring him to birth contemporaneously with significant companions of that distant past, so that life could afford him opportunity to make restitution. The sinner must pay his own debts, but the love of Christ gives him, so to speak, the earning power. Zalm had been diligent in mining and geology in the early part of his career, so, as Pearson, mining again brings him prosperity in goldfields of California Atlantis. A higher concept of unselfish service has replaced the intense ambition of Zalm. Although he never again on earth sees his true love, the former Anzimi, he meets Elizabeth, Lilix of old, now outcast of a good family, sinking into a degraded life in a mining town. In a completely unselfish way he makes it possible for her to rehabilitate herself in other surroundings, but thereafter loses sight of her for several years. At length they meet again, marry, and are again parents of two children. Whereas in Atlantis their relation had been sub rosa, and their children not cherished, now all is open and honest, the children dearly loved, but disregard of those children ages ago is balanced now by their early death, to the intense sorrow of the parents. In the course of his career Pearson comes under the influence of spiritual teachers, sometimes in unexpected guise, and is benefited by many instances of leading and protection. One lesson he learns which might well be taken to heart by aspirants who complain that their mundane environment keeps them from devoting more time to higher pursuits. His guide takes him to the planet Venus, hence the title of the book, for a stay in the advanced and happy conditions of life there, in company of many he had known and loved on Earth, and who had progressed further than he on the path of enlightenment. In a short time Pearson discovers that he is not content in this realm of perfect happiness. He is like a grade school pupil allowed to visit college, at first delighted with the freedom, but soon finding that he is not yet ready to take part in that more advanced life. Nevertheless, his time on Venus is highly profitable. On the material side, the Venusians introduce him to much in science and technology half a century or more in advance of anything known on Earth. On the spiritual side, they teach him great truths. The actual experiences are forgotten upon his return to Earth, but his character is purified and strengthened. After further work and tests, both in our everyday world and on higher planes, Pearson attains that illumination which enables him to graduate from the school of human life, so that after his death he becomes Philos, one of the men beyond mankind. For more than half a century a dweller on two planets,